Hello, and welcome to episode 57 of the Blue Cup Tools podcast. I am Francisco Gonzalez, also known as G-R-U-N-D-I-S-L-A-V, Grundislav, and with me as always...
Hello, I am Ben Chandler, also known as Ben304. How are you today, Grundislav?
I'm all right. I'm very slightly hungover, but I'll make it as we go. How are you?
I'm well. You know, I never understood the concept of the term hungover. Does it mean like you've been hungover a rail or something?
Maybe. That's kind of what it feels like in more extreme cases. I'm only slightly hungover, so I just feel like I'm kind of tired. That's all.
You're resting gently upon this rail.
Yes, exactly.
I like to think about like where words come from, and you know, we use so many terms that we don't actually like. They're portmanteaus, and you don't think of why those two words are together.
That's true.
So I like to think about those sort of things. But anyway, being hungover aside, how's your week been?
Good. The reason I'm hungover is because last night was the indie game developer drink night, and so I went and I was owed a drink by one Miranda Govan, and so she. I had one more drink than I normally would have had, so...
And being old, this tip you over the edge.
Uh-huh, exactly.
Mm. So, fair enough.
Yeah, I almost fell asleep. Well, I kind of did fall asleep on the subway ride back, and it was, yeah, it was great. It was a fun, eventful time.
I was going to just play the game that you just told me about before the podcast, and say... When you woke.
Oh, yes.
Golden.
Yes. Let's not go there. But no,
let's move on.
It's been a good week. It's 1 week, speaking of terrible segues, it's 1 week till the release of Golden Wake. There's a demo out as of yesterday, so if you haven't checked it out, check it out. Hopefully you'll
like
it.
Where can people get that demo from?
They can get it all over the place. They can go to the Wajidai site. They can go to... Which, if you type in www.goldenwake.com, all one word, it'll take you there automatically. And you can download it there. Yes, you can download it there directly for Windows, Mac, or Linux. You can also look for it on Steam, because it's on Steam. And also for Windows, Mac, and Linux. So you have no excuse.
Can GOG users get it on GOG, or is that...
GOG users, no, they cannot get it on GOG until the actual release a year from now, a week from now.
Well, to be honest, most of the GOG games have been, you know, they're like 20 years old, so I'm sure these people are willing to wait another week.
Yeah, if you can wait 20 years, you can wait a week. But aside from that, I went to go see a really terrible play called Alan Smithy directed this play.
Oh, Alan Smithy, that's the go-to name for people who want to take their, like, directors who want to take their names off a film, isn't it?
That is absolutely correct, and I'm proud of you for knowing that.
I'm a film buff, I know these things.
Oh, fuck off, you're a film buff.
I actually, and I know nobody knew this because it doesn't make a sound effect, but I actually winked when I said that's how pleased I was with me for knowing it.
Wow.
So tell me about this. I mean, the name Alan Smithy doesn't inspire confidence in anybody that knows what it means. So.
Exactly. Yeah, and to title your play Alan Smithy directed this play. I already figured going in that it was going to be pretty terrible.
Yeah.
But having said that, it wasn't terrible. It was just terrible. How do I describe the difference here?
Okay. I don't know.
So the actors were all very, very good. They were really, really good. There was this one lady who in particular was really good, and she sang really nice too. And they all danced very nicely.
So was it a musical play?
No, it was not a musical play. There were bits of music in it, but it was not a musical play. They used Knights in White Satin as a backing track a couple of times.
You did tell me that, because we've been listening to Moody Blues.
Yeah, and prog rock as well. But no, generally it was very well acted, and it was very well put together, and it was interesting, I guess, but it made no sense whatsoever, because it was pretty much just them randomly switching between talking about the 1918 Bolshevik Revolution, peppered with dialogue from the films Dr. Zhivago and Terms of Endearment, which I have not seen, so I didn't quite get the references, but...
That sounds like an utterly bewildering mix of things.
It really was. And utterly bewildering is the perfect description of this play. But I still enjoyed it.
It has me so bewildered, I couldn't say bewildering.
Even more so because it was free, because Miranda Govan works for the Brooklyn Academy of Music, so she got us free tickets, and she got us third row orchestra, so we were right there, so that was lovely. Nice. Yeah, it lovely. Was it was real nice. So, yeah, that was good. Thanks, Miranda.
Thank you, Miranda. So for letting me showcase my film buff knowledge, that is very minimal, but actually, I actually got something for once. So I'm actually, you know, this podcast for me, I'm done. I'm like, I'm going to phone the rest in, literally.
Oh, okay. So yeah, that's pretty much been my week. How about yours?
My week's been good. Yeah. My, as you know, the drummer of my band was in a... Did I tell you this? He was in an accident.
He was in an accident.
He was in a car accident, and we've got a fairly important gig coming up. So we've been practicing extra because we've got a replacement drummer. Mm-hmm. And so we've been practicing extra much. So I haven't had a great deal of free time to play games or anything like that because we've been trying to get the new guy on board. And,
sure.
And, you know, so we've got a tight act when the day comes. But, you know, I got a new computer, which is an old Pentium 120.
You have to specify 32. That new is in quotation marks.
Well, new to me. It's a new possession for me. Mm. In terms of actual technological age, it's not that new.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I've been wanting for quite a while a PC in which I can install a 5.25-inch floppy drive and, you know, and one that runs DOS natively and Windows 3.1. So this is the one. I haven't got the 5.25-inch floppy drive in yet, but that's on the cards for some point. And I've played a few games on it. And
you said it was a Pentium 120, right?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Because yeah. I was going to say that sounds very much like the computer that I had circa 1992, but it was a 486, so it
yeah okay. Well, this is powerful. slightly more
advanced. Yeah, but it did have DOS native and it had Windows 3.1. So
uh-huh.
Ba-ba! Yeah.
Good. Yeah, so it's it's been one of my
those are my Windows 3.1 sounds.
Good. It's been one of my sort of goals to get a 3.1 and DOS 6 computer, which also has a 5.25-inch floppy drive, because I've got all these 5.25-inch games,
mm-hmm.
and I've been looking for a USB, because you can get the 3.5-inch floppy in USB very easily,
sure.
But I've never seen one for 5.25-inch yet, so I thought it's time to, time to do this.
Yeah, sure, why not?
So, so I got that, and I've been working on the game that shall not be named, and
yeah, good.
We actually had a fairly interesting week of, like, reassessing certain design, reassessing, like, our direction a little bit, and, putting our heads together and going, this isn't quite how I'd figured it.
And we had some good contributions from our boss man, from Dave Gilbert.
Yeah, from Dave. And it was interesting, like, you sent me the latest...
Oops, I got a text. Go ahead.
You should put your phone on silent.
I should put my phone on silent when we podcast.
I
would like to, as a slice of life thing, the text is from my mother, and she said, "Lord help me, these kids are dumb," with 4 exclamation marks.
Is she talking about us?
No, my mother is a teacher.
Yeah, I know.
Oh, maybe she's listening and she's live tweeting us about.
No, texting. She says not. She thinks nice things about me.
That's true. Anyway,
we have similar taste in music and games, so
correct.
You know.
Yes.
But yeah, it was interesting. You sent me the build that you'd been working on today, like with some new dialogue and stuff like that. And after I'd voiced some of my concerns and we'd gone through some stuff with Dave, and the build I played today, I was a lot more... it resonated a lot more with me than the previous build I played, where I felt it was a little too adventure gamey.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's kind of nice to, like... I really like a game when you've got, like, a bit that you're not quite sure about, and then you discuss it, and you put your heads together, and you say your stuff, and then you play it afterwards, and you can genuinely tell that it's already a stronger game just because of that sort of progress. So, yeah, I really like that. That's a really nice feeling for me.
Yeah, good. I was going to say something, but I got distracted by the fact that I got a text.
Yeah, it's other people are distracting.
I know. So anyway, you haven't played any games this week?
Well, I've played, like, bits and bobs. Like, bits and pieces here and there. A few, you know, things to test out my latest acquisition, good. I'll say, in PC. I started playing a bit of Child of Light, but I didn't play much because, like I said, I haven't had much time.
Yeah, sure.
To play. So, have you been playing any games this week?
I have not been playing any games.
Well, aren't we both dullards?
I know. I keep meaning to play 1954 Alcatraz, but I just haven't been able to sit down and play it. Maybe
you've been going at. We've both been going at a fair bit. I want to say.
We've been having pretty increased social outing lives.
It's disgusting.
Things. I know it really is. I really should stay in more and just be more of a hermit.
But these days, like, someone rang me up and was like, oh, come out tonight. And I was like, no, I've been out every night this week. I want to stay home and be a nerd on my old computer and play Doom 2.
That's what I'm doing tonight. It's Friday night.
Yes. So that's what I did. I was just like, I'm just going to stay home and play pinball and Doom 2 and, you know, just... I've been out every other night.
Sometimes you need a break. I mean, I like going out as much as the next person, but there's just times where I just want to be by myself, you know, just in my underpants in my apartment and having a nice alone time, which doesn't mean what you might think it means.
Yeah, I was going to say the conjecture is already raised on that
one. No. Anyway, but I'd also like to point out that despite the fact that I've had a social life, last night at the drink night, I spent quite a significant amount of time reciting the intros to three separate LucasArts games along with Anatoly. Boing. We did them word for word and in unison, and it was something.
You've been reciting the Sam and Max introduction to me once a week.
I've only done it once.
No, you have not. That is an absolute load
of bollocks. Okay, maybe I've done it twice.
You've done it more than twice, I can promise you this.
How dare
you? In the last month, you've probably done it three times.
You're imagining things. You know what it is?
I'm not imagining.
It was so good and so on point that you just thought that I've done it more than I've actually done it. That's what it is.
Maybe it's because I played it recently and so
Maybe.
I don't know. But you've been doing it a fair bit.
But we did Full Throttle, and then we did Sam & Max, and then we did Day of the Tentacle. How long
has it been since you played through Full Throttle?
When was the last time you played it before this most recent one?
Last year.
I played it a few
around weeks. The same time. It was a little over a year when I did my current playthrough since I'd last played through it.
Well, I did my last playthrough a little while after you did your second to last playthrough, so it's been about a year for me as well.
Okay.
But I have I've played Day of the Tentacle more recently, and
yes, I know because I was playing it, and then you went and played it, and it was a kind of every time I play an old game, you seem to get inspired to pick it up and an older game, which I mean I can totally understand because you get reminded of the good times.
But nowadays I feel bad replaying the old ones because I have so many other old ones that I haven't played yet, and so I'm like, well.
Yeah, but it's a different thing for me. It's a totally different thing, you know? It's like buying a new album of music and listening to it and enjoying it and then going back and listening to an old favorite, for me, anyway.
Yeah, true, I guess.
You know, that's how I personally view it.
Fair enough. Anyway, what are we talking about this week on this lovely Blue Cup podcast?
We've covered a whole different range of the diverse and various topics.
Mm-hmm.
The different sort of disciplines involved in making a game, whether it be the art side, the technical side, the music side, the organization side, but we're going to try and talk about, and it's a kind of a difficult subject because it's a little more obtuse to get a grasp on and identify, but we're going to talk about the actual whole process of making a game, not as a activity or as a career or job, but as an actual skill set.
Good. You know what else is obtuse and difficult to get a grasp on?
Yes.
Good. I'm glad you do. Now let's talk about our subject.
So, one thing I have to say I've always admired about you, and, you know, all the other skill sets aside and, like, you know, how good you are at certain individual things, I think it has to be said that, you know, it's very admirable that in all of the, like, the people that have come to AGS and had these very ambitious plans and ideas, you're one of the very few that have sort of gone, I'm going to make an 8-part game or I'm going to do this big project and then stuck with it and finished it off. You know, obviously, there's this really weird thing that I noticed with AGS, and it happened to me and it happens to most people, I think, is and in indie games in general, when you're doing a lot of it yourself or as a part of a very small team, is that you come in very ambitious And after failing to achieve your ambition quite a bit, you cut your ambitions down by quite a lot and then try and just make something achievable.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, you kind of slowly build your ambition up again, or you get too scared to build your ambition up again, as I was for a little while. And a lot of the times, by the time you sort of have run out of steam to, like you've run out of excitement, like, when it's not exciting anymore. Like, not that it's not exciting and interesting, but there's a point where the glimmer wears off and you've got to really sit down and do the boring stuff of making a game.
Sure. Every game has a honeymoon period. Every project, yeah, you get excited about it. And then, yeah, when you sit down and realize how much work it actually is, that's when it's easy to say, oh my God, what did I get myself into? And then freak out and lose ambition, whatever. But anyway, you were saying.
But I think one thing that worries me for a lot of new developers is they go through their big ambition stage, and then some people achieve that. You know, you look at guys like, you know, Ali with Nelly Kudelot and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. You know, these are really ambitious projects, really cool things that happen. Vince with Resonance and all that sort of stuff, and they manage to do that. And then you kind of wonder, well, I mean, Vince has done obviously smaller stuff where he's gone in and he's made, you know, sort of game jam length games and mm-hmm. stuff like that. But I wonder, like, if people sort of use up all of their energy, if they get to the point where they stop making games and they've never really feel like they satisfied their potential because they kind of hit that point where they tried the ambitious thing, and either that worked or that didn't work. But then they were worn out, so they went and moved on to the less ambitious thing. And then, you know, you never really get anywhere from there. I don't know if that really makes sense, but, like, I always worry that a lot of really cool projects never really reach their potential or kind of get cancelled. I mean, you know how many AGS projects have been cancelled. And I have to say, it's really nice, like, a lot of... I mean, I know you're probably the same as me. You've made a lot of friends in the time you've been around the sort of indie game community.
No, because I'm just a hateful person, and everybody I meet, I just go bah! At them.
Okay, well, you've made a lot of contacts that you hate, and you know, you've seen a lot of projects that you think that's really great. I can't wait to play that. And you sort of 5 years on, you sum up how many of those cool old projects you got to play, and often it's a very disheartening number.
Yeah.
You know? And it's really cool for me to have someone like you around that you go, you know, he's been there, he's done that same journey where, you know, you actually managed to finish all this stuff and make your games. For me, that's like, it's nice to know that, you know, because one thing that really sort of used to dishearten me is you talk to a lot of AGS, like, regulars, and they all have this same attitude of, oh, none of us actually finish our games. And I'm like, oh, don't give up, guys, you know?
Yeah. Well, you know, yeah, I can say the same thing at risk of deviating this podcast into another humid bromance fest. But yeah, it's inspiring to have a fellow person who has been in that same situation. And, well, I mean, it's gotten to the point where we're working on a game together, so
yeah,
that's good for something, I suppose.
I think when you come to the point where you're a bit jaded, like, you know, you see all these ambitious new projects and you do get jaded and you're like, oh, I wonder if they're ever going to finish it, rather than, oh man, I can't wait to play that, you know?
Yeah, it is sure. Nice, if you see...
It is nice when you sort of, you're forming a partnership, in our case, and you genuinely have confidence that the other person is going to stick it.
It gets sad when it's to the point where, like, you know, you see a games in production thread on the AGS forums and it looks really cool, and you think you find yourself thinking, oh yeah, that's never gonna get done, rather than
you do start to view ambition as a folly rather than as a boon.
Which is
a shame, because ambition is utterly important for developing a game, which is satisfying and rewarding. I'm sure of that.
It is, but unfortunately I guess it's just, I don't know, human nature or something, to just have your ambition weigh you down more than power you along. Because, I mean, it's always nice to be proven wrong. I mean, look at Donna, Avenger of Blood. That game was in development for like 10 years. And it finally came out, and I still haven't played it. And, God, I should. I really should. And maybe I will. Like, today.
Sorry, Goldman.
Sorry. Yeah. But...
I've played it.
So yeah, things like that, it's really cool. And like other, well, look at Resonance. Resonance took 5 years.
Exactly. But it finally that's a long time.
Crossed the finish line.
But, that's a long time. It always gets me. I look at stuff like Braid and, you know, Jonathan Blow was like he was like this crazy superstar guy when I was first starting to make games, you know?
Mm-hmm.
He was the guy that had done it, you know? I'd been doing it for just a little while and he'd gone and done it and success and I'd done nothing. And now I'm like, I'm at the point where I'm making games full time and I look at Jonathan Blow and I'm like,
well, you've made more games than Jonathan Blow.
Which is, it's kind of,
hell, even I've made more unfair games to compare than because my, Blow.
Yeah, because, but like the things we work on are obviously more completable and stuff, but I do worry like that he's gotten himself into this 6 year rut, which is a long time.
It is.
You know, and, yeah, I worry about that. And I want to sort of start this topic off by talking about finding your limits in terms of game making and learning to identify them and working past them. Because I know for me personally, a thing that really used to get me stuck was doing backgrounds. You know, I didn't have skill at drawing a background. I had no idea what I was doing. So if you look at some of my earlier stuff, like Any Android is probably the best example. I basically made a game sort of designed around the fact that I wouldn't have to do any backgrounds for it. So if you look at the backgrounds for Any Android, they're really, really simple. There's really nothing to them. And my idea there was rather than doing super detailed, super complex scenery that would take me forever to do and actually demotivate me to the point where I didn't want to work on the game anymore, it was to design around that fact, you know, recognize that that was a bottleneck for me, that was a stopping point in my projects, and say, okay, I'm going to do all of the backgrounds in a single night. And that's what I did. I designed a style where I could do that. And that actually, you know, and before I knew it, the game was done because I'd identified a stopping point of mine and worked around it, you know. I think we were talking last time about people designing without really knowing how to code and how difficult that can be.
Yeah.
And when it comes to implementing stuff, if you recognize that coding's not your strong point, you learn to design around that and you design simpler stuff but more creative in other ways than technically.
Yeah, because I mean I can't count the number of times when I was thinking about stuff to do and I was like, I would get ideas and I'm like, oh, but how would I code that? I don't know how to code that. So in some cases, I was able to ask for help and get the things coded. Other times, I just had to change things around slightly to the point where I coded it as I could, you know, within my skill set, within my limitations, I guess you could say.
I think the point there is either you learn to compromise and make something which isn't achievable, or you learn to establish a partnership where somebody who has a more advanced level of expertise in the area that you find a stopping point can help you through that.
Yeah. I think doing like little mini projects and game jams and things like that is a good way to kind of get everything together and kind of learn what your skills are, especially under pressure.
Yeah, you learn your limitations as well.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you learn to design. I don't think game jams teach you much more than the idea of having an iterative design where you can go, you know, you come up with a very basic form of your concept, and then from there you go, all right, well, this concept could be expanded on if we had the time, you know. So adventure games are a little odd like that because we build in a very linear fashion, a lot of us.
Yeah.
And you know, I think, like, one of the things, like, a serious blocking point for you and I would be writing our own engine of making people walking around and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah.
There's no interest there. So the solution there is to use an engine like AGS, which takes care of that side of things for us.
Right.
You know? That's just one example of, you know, and then asking people for help doing music, asking for, you know, help doing everything like that. And also, there's some things you can't do yourself. You can't accurately test a game properly by yourself. I firmly believe that. That's true. You can squash bugs, but you can't test from a design perspective by yourself a lot of the times. You know, sometimes it's really hard to do that. So I think a really important thing to be able to objectively, or at least sort of remove yourself from, I want to do everything myself and I've got the best game in the world and I'm going to make this amazing project, to go, what's holding me up? Why is my project not getting done? Why am I failing all these games? Because I've stopped working on a lot of games.
Yes, you know, which is a shame, especially, because you've had some really good ones that I've been looking forward to playing and now they're not going to be made. Boo-hoo-hoo-hoo.
The biggest problem with me is early on,
I'm looking at you, Tethered Fate.
Yeah.
And Mildred. And Ortis. And you are a cat. And cat butt. And shall I go on? Or will we... I think that'll take up the rest of the podcast.
An interesting thing for me, and this is something I was discussing with someone the other day, is when I first started making games, as I said before, you know, I had these really ambitious project ideas. I mean, I made a game in my first 2 weeks of using AGS, which, you know... That sort of set the tone for me fairly early.
So did I, actually. But, although it was a reality on the Norm game, but still.
Yeah, but that's still an achievement.
Yeah,
you know?
I guess.
So I made a game in my first 2 weeks, and then I tried from then. I was like, okay, well, I've made a game. Now I'm going to make something good, you know. Like, now I've done that. I've done that. You know, I'm a game developer now, so now I'm going to make something good, and it's going to blow people away. It'll be the best new adventure game in that. And
that's a great attitude. Get made. I didn't start thinking that I was a game developer until, like, a month ago.
Okay. Well, no, I was like, well, I've made a game. I can do this. You know, I had that attitude of, okay, this is doable, you know? And so I had these huge ambitious plans, and those games never get made, you know? Well, I don't want to say never, but I was 18 years old, you know, I didn't know what I was doing.
When you're 18 years old, you feel like you can do anything. You can jump off a cliff and survive. And
that's right. You're going to,
you're on the top of the world, Ma.
Yeah, you have all these dreams, and it's awesome that you've got those dreams, because those dreams are what keep you going. Those dreams are what keep you turning on the computer, starting AGS up, and trying to learn how to do this stuff.
Yes.
But, you know, those projects, those really ambitious projects of mine never ended up going anywhere. And I got into this sort of, this area of self-doubt where I'm like, man, nothing I do is getting done. I don't know if I can do this. And so what I started doing, and a lot of people who've played my games probably realize this, is I started really cutting down my ambition and just making stuff I knew I could finish. That was my main goal. My main goal was just to learn how to finish games, learn how to have projects that I could finish. So I just did really small projects and just, you know, and everyone was like, this is too small. I'm like, it's not too small because I managed to finish it. So it's perfect, you know, any bigger. And I don't think I would have stuck it out.
Yeah. That's kind of what happened to me. Well, finish your story.
But then what happened was that I had learned how to finish projects and I'd learned how to stick with projects, and I was still in that same mindset of making little, not very ambitious things. Mm-hmm. And so I had all of these little projects, which about, you know, five of which you just named, none of which were very ambitious. And because they weren't very ambitious, they didn't inspire me anymore. Does that make sense? So I had trouble working on them because I was like, oh, well, yeah, I could finish this, but what's the point? You know, it is sad, but I cured that by starting to work on more ambitious games, you know. All of a sudden, you know, I'd work for Dave on Black Wheel Deception, and when I worked for him on Deception, he just sort of said at one point, oh, would you be interested in doing backgrounds? And I was like, no, I can't do backgrounds for 30, you know, 40 scenes. That's crazy. And then when he asked me again in Epiphany, if I remember right, he actually said to me, because Indrek actually had to drop out of doing the backgrounds for the game, and which was, I was kind of disappointed about, because, you know, we'd work, it was cool in Deception, everything had come together fast, and it was it was really cool to like see this game just sort of take shape. But when he asked me about the sort of, he was like, oh, I suppose you're going to say no, but I got to ask, are you interested in doing backgrounds in Epiphany? I'd done Piss by that point, which at that stage was the biggest project I've ever done. I was like, you know what? I can probably do this because, you know, even though Dave was like, Epiphany is going to be 40 backgrounds again, which it ended up being like 76.
Yeah.
He was like, and I was like, well, if I'm not doing 40 backgrounds for this game, I'm going to be doing 40 backgrounds for something else.
Mm-hmm.
and this is what I'm inspired to work on now. So by actually finding stuff that was more ambitious, I found my motivation back again, you know? I had to get out of that mindset of I should only work on easy things that I can achieve, because that wasn't enough to drive me anymore. I'd actually lost that ability to finish games by the fact that I'd gotten to the point where I was like, well, yeah, I could do it, but what's the point, you know? And then all of a sudden I had a point because, hey, this is going to be a big game. It's going to be more than just an interesting little pastime for me. So it was weird to just kind of see how that worked for me by something that worked for me at first, cutting my ambition down and keeping it manageable, ended up not working for me in the long run once I'd actually got the skill to finish a game, because that wasn't anything that excited me anymore. Mm. I had to have something more. And now, like, you know, the project we're currently working on, I'm excited about it. Like the Techno Babylon, which I finished a month or so ago, it was exciting to me because I've got this big project and I'm like, I've got so much scope to push myself and to do different textures and ideas and all of this stuff within a single project. This is going to be a big game and it's going to be something people remember. And it's the same for the project we're working on now. You know, I'm like, this is something, you know, this is going to be a game worth playing, you know? That's, I think, well, correct me if I'm wrong, but you feel the same way, where every single game that you've made, at some point, you've been like, this is the game that I should be making at this point.
Yeah. You really believe in it. Sure.
You wouldn't make it if you didn't believe in it.
No, you're absolutely right. I just, like, I was laughing at the way you said, this is going to be a game worth playing.
Well, it is.
It was funny. I liked the way you said that. It was
okay. Well, I'll continue to talk with sort of resolve then.
Good, please do. But on my end, actually, it's funny because, I mean, well, would you consider the Ben Jordan series ambitious?
I would.
See,
yeah.
It's funny that you say that because actually, it was kind of the opposite for me. Like, when I started making my game, when I started making games, I made Reality on the Norm games, which were really short. And, I mean, even though they were short, I tried to make them interesting. You know, it wasn't like, there was a lot of people at that time, they were making there was a lot of people making Reality on the Norm games, but there was also a lot of people that were making them, like, good ones. Like, you know, Dave Gilbert and Creed Malay.
Yeah, there was,
and, like,
there was kind of, like, there was kind of a paradigm shift at some point where people were like, this might be Reality on the Norm, but we can do a real story in this.
Exactly. So, I mean, it was like that very much at the beginning. That's where it started from. Unfortunately, later on, it became much more about quantity versus quality. But, you know, there were good Reality on the Norm games. But, well, go ahead.
I mean, kind of a paradigm shift in AGS games. I think I forget what it's called. What's the game that starts with P that's old?
What? P as in, like, P or P as in the letter?
The letter.
Oh.
What's it called?
It's a Reality on the Norm game?
No. It's an AGS game. It was, like, the first big and ambitious AGS game.
Primordia? You
know, no. Old.
Plurgberg!
That's it, Plurgberg. Plurgberg.
please keep saying it like that. That's great.
Plurgberg.
Plurgberg. Yeah, Plurgberg.
Yeah, so Plurgberg kind of felt like a paradigm shift in, like, the community where, like, you've got, I mean, I wasn't around at that point, but that's the feeling I got, where you've got, like, okay, this is an engine, and all of a sudden people are like, wow, you can make games with this.
Yeah,
you know?
Sure. And even before that, there was Permanent Daylight, which was like, oh wow.
Permanent Daylight was the first AGS game I played, actually, and I loved it.
Yeah, it was really charming and quirky, and it wasn't a long game, but it was very well put together, and this was, it was like, that was one of the first games that it was like, okay, you can use this to make LucasArts-style adventure games, definitely.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, I mean, I had played, like, Rob Blank in the early Reality on the Norm games, which Yahtzee makes decent games, but he's not a really good artist, so it was, you know.
Sure.
It didn't look like, you know, the old stuff. But anyway, I digress. The whole reason I brought this up was because, so I had made a couple of Reality on the Norm games, and I had, you know, even though they were small projects, I liked, it was interesting to, you know, tell stories and stuff and just, like, whatever.
I think the cool thing at that early stage is it's just exciting to have made a game.
Oh, yeah, you know? Sure.
That's enough.
Well, I made 3 Reality on the Norm games in, like, the span of a year, so...
Yeah.
Anyway, so then I moved on to other projects, which I won't talk about because they're but then I kind of got ambitious, and I was like, okay, so I've made all these little games. It's time to start focusing on a big project. And so I came up with the idea of Granny Zombie Killer, which I'm sure you probably have heard me talk about. And
I've played it. I've played the demo.
Yeah. Well, so anyway, Granny Zombie Killer was going to be my big thing, and I was trying, you know, at the time I thought that I was doing really nice high-res Curse of Monkey Island style backgrounds and art and stuff, and I bought that animator's toolkit.
Survival kit?
Yeah, which actually helped quite a bit in, like, you know,
doing the walk cycles. It's a very full book in terms of how much information can be gleaned from it.
Absolutely. But, so, that project ended up not going anywhere because it was very much killed by ambition. So yeah. I realized, you know, I was just like, well, you know, and also I think I had been burned out by doing the other high-res game that I did, which never got released.
I know the one.
Yes.
I know the one.
Which, I mean, that one, I put a lot of work into that game, and it's kind of stupid that I never, well, it's not stupid that I never released it because it would have been a very much... very embarrassing thing to do. But anyway, the point is it was a good learning experience, but that was also like a really big project. So then I decided high res wasn't for me, and I went back to low res, and I was going to start working on this other big project about like the globetrotting kid that goes looking for the AGS source code or whatever.
Yes.
And at that point, I kind of got big project fatigue, and then I thought, well, you know what? If I'm going to do something, I think I should go back to the Reality on the Norm type thing where I just make a bunch of small games. But I decided to make, rather than do what you did and make my small games about different things and different worlds, I just decided to make an episodic series. And so that's where Ben Jordan spawned from. And I, of course, made 3 games in 1 year and then sort of subsequently took longer between them. But yeah, I was very much committed to that project. And I mean, I did... you know, take little breaks and make other little small games here and there. But yeah, so now I'm back on big projects again because the Golden Wake was a big project and the Scottish game is a big project. And now I'm just kind of focusing on that now, which because I've had this experience of doing all this other stuff, I now feel that I am ready to tackle big projects and not run out of steam or just get fatigued by them or anything. Because oddly enough, I never got sick of a Golden Wake. And yeah, so I guess that's a good thing.
I think it's a combination of two different things. I think it's an advancement of skill to the point where instead of going, oh, how am I going to do this background? Another one that I don't really know how to do. I'm just guessing my way through it. Yeah. You approach new things with a knowledge of how to do it, and also it's a confidence in, oh, well, I've done a game with 80 backgrounds before.
Yeah, exactly.
I can do this. So that those both inspire confidence and also persistence in a person, I think.
Definitely. But as far as that too, I think also because I mean we're speaking from the perspective of you know, multiple skilled jack of all trades types. But I think it's the same thing if you work on a team. I mean, look at Dave. Like, you know, he's worked. All of his games have been team efforts. All of his commercial games, certainly. And
even Reality on the Norm, he had like other assets there.
Well, yeah, that's true. So, but Dave has the experience and the skill of having worked of project management and being, you know, and knowing how to pick your team members. And I mean, he's gone through, he's used some of the same people. I mean, well, now he has you full time, but he's, you know, on every single project, he basically had more or less a different team. It wasn't the same team all the time.
Dave went through a lot of art. I mean, Thomas stuck with him doing music, you know. That was quite a long thing. But Dave went through a lot of artists.
Yeah. So, so he's been able to, you know, figure that out, I guess.
An interesting thing Dave said to me is he kind of lost faith in AGS people in terms of being able to work on a big project. And, you know, he was looking to outside things because so many of the AGS people at the time were quite inexperienced, and, you know, and then when it came to working on Blackwell Deception, he'd actually had a different artist that was working with us at the very start, but he was very slow and he was struggling, and Dave was like, look, this isn't working out, you know, I'm going to have to look elsewhere. Uh-huh. And he got Indrek on board. And Indrek had been around since before I was in AGS. And so all of a sudden he had these two AGS people. And I still consider myself very inexperienced and very new to the whole being an artist thing. But in terms of making an AGS game at that point, I was fairly experienced and so was Indrek. So all of a sudden his kind of faith in AGS people got kind of restored by the fact that he had these two guys that had finally had some skill and some... like, you know, had the thing of, oh, it's 40 backgrounds, we'll do it. Oh, it's you know, mm-hmm. it's 30 characters to animate, we'll do this. Rather than people like, I want to make games, and I'm pretty good at drawing, mm-hmm. let's work together. You know, that's a really big difference, I think. You know, my biggest thing, and I say this a fair bit, like, anybody can write a good piece of dialogue. Anybody can paint a good background. Anyone can do a good animation. If you give them 2 months and say, work on that one thing for those 2 months, it's going to come out great. You can redo it enough times. You can fix it. You can tweak it. You can polish it. It's going to come out pretty good.
Mm.
But in order to get a big game done, you need to be able to sit there every day and consistently, you know, produce a standard. And that's where it's important to go back and identify your weaknesses. If it's like, well, it takes me 3 months to get a single background right, maybe you're doing something that you could, you know, maybe you could do it differently.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not saying you shouldn't spend 3 months on a single dialogue, but I'm saying
well,
it's going to be really hard.
You shouldn't spend 3 months on a single dialogue.
But, well, I mean, if that's what it takes to get the most important dialogue of your game right, like the final dialogue or whatever, then that's what it takes.
I guess.
But if you're trying to do that for a whole game and you've got, you know, and you've got 70 different dialogues and it takes you 3 months to get each one right, it's either going to take you a very long time or you will run out of motivation and enthusiasm before you finish.
Yeah.
And that's a sad truth, but it is a truth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that's where it's important to learn to compromise, to learn to identify your weaknesses and stuff like that. And yeah, I think also another thing, because
fun fact, lady boys and girls, just because I was, if it took you 3 months to do a dialogue and you had 70 dialogues, your game would take 17 and a half years to get made. Mm.
There you go. I was exaggerating for the point of illustration, but you know what I mean.
Like, I do.
You know, and for me,
that's
it was
longer
like,
than Duke Nukem Forever.
That says everything, and that didn't come out very good.
Nope.
So for me, like, that's why I learned to sort of draw very simply. Mm. I tried to find a very effective but very simple art style, you know, and that worked for me. And like you said, you cut down on doing the high res because it burned you out.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about
identifying. And also, I wasn't very good at it, so I figured it was frustrating also to just not be able to, you know, have it look good.
Well, I think the thing there is that your standards change as well.
Yeah, true. Well, hell yeah, I look at some of my low res stuff now, and I'm like, how the hell did I get away with that? So yeah.
Sure, we all think that.
Yeah.
But like, yeah, another thing also, and I used to say this. I used to teach guitar a bit, and I used to say this to the people that I was teaching guitar to, and this isn't a rule, but it really helps. If you want to be a musician, you got to love music. Mm. It's the only thing that'll give you the passion to keep practicing. And it's the same, I think, for AGS or any game. If you want to be a game developer, you got to love games, because it's the only thing that'll keep you going. The only time I can think of game developers that didn't love games... Mm. is the developers of Myst, who did it all in like pieces of paper. They actually beta tested the game by writing out the puzzles as like written down scenarios and giving it to people to solve, like just as on things on pieces of paper.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's how they tested their design concept. And they've said in interviews, you know, oh, I'm not a big fan of games.
How
I don't think video games are good.
They?
Yeah, but I mean, so for me, if you really, really love games, like I look at you, you go out to a bar and you recite the introductions of three classic adventure games. Clearly you love adventure games, you know?
Yeah.
You've got that passion there, which is what it takes, I think, to something. And for me, you know, I remember Shane Stevens, Proximax, saying to...
Ben, I don't want to interrupt you there for a second, yeah? But I have a question for you.
Tell me.
We're friends, right?
Yeah.
Friends? Friends? We've only gone out together three times, and already you're telling me you just want to be... Sorry. You were saying?
I remember Shane Stevens, also known as Proximax, telling me one day, you know, he said, when I get to that point where I can't work on games anymore, I'm not inspired, he said, what I do is I just go and I play the games that I like and remember why I like them. Every time I play Full Throttle's crazy for me because it's super intense to play it. Like, I play it really slowly. Like, you can play through Full Throttle in, like, 40 minutes.
Oh, yeah, sure.
But I can't because it's, like, a really intense thing for me. Like, Full Throttle, I was fairly late to playing Full Throttle, and I was like, first starting to make games, and I played Full Throttle, and I was like, oh, man, this is how games should be. This is atmosphere. This is writing. This is design. You know, this is... So for me, going back and revisiting that each time, it really inspires those memories of me. It's actually a really intense experience for me to play Full Throttle because it's like this is why I started making games, you know? It's the same thing when I think about Planescape Torment. That's the reason I make games, is games like that. I want to see more like that. You know, that's the stuff that keeps me going. So for me, playing games and being able to appreciate the art form is... It's essential to be able to feel like it's something that you want to do with your life.
Yeah, I feel the same way. Yeah, there's certain games that I play, and every time I play them, they inspire me too. Like Gabriel Knight 1, for example.
Sure.
Actually, I've been meaning to replay the entire Quest for Glory series because those are
pretty you said that
too. Yeah.
When you say the entire series,
yes.
Do you include number 5?
Yes, of course I include number 5.
Okay.
I like number 5.
Good.
I think it's actually a decent ending to the series, even though it strays a bit from the classic formula, but that's not a bad thing.
Okay. I know a lot of people dislike it. I've had people get cross with me for suggesting that it was, you know...
Well, those people are silly, and you can tell them I said that.
I'll write that down. I'll write it down Quest and get you to
Glory,
sign it.
I'm going on record right now on this podcast, and I'm saying that Quest for Glory 5 is a valid entry in the series. And furthermore...
Just like King's Quest 8.
No. No. No, because King's Quest 8...
You haven't...
No, because King's Quest... I know I haven't played King's Quest 8, but I've seen enough of it to know that King's Quest 8 is a complete departure from... That's like if Quest for Glory 5 was all of a sudden about, like, another hero in another land and, you know, had nothing to do whatsoever, had only a very, very, you know, small... Well, the King's Quest games, you can forgive that.
They change constantly.
They change protagonists, but it was all the royal family of Daventry. King's Quest 8 is just some guy who lives in Daventry, and they don't even really mention the royal family. He just goes on this completely ridiculous... action quest. Whereas at least Quest for Glory 5, it's still in the world. There's plenty of characters from, some would say maybe too many characters from the previous games. It's still a consistent experience, you know, even though it's 3D and even though they changed up the combat. But they changed the combat in every Quest for Glory game. And yeah, it's not as consistent and like the stats don't matter as much anymore, but this is turning now into a rant on why Quest for Glory 5 is good.
I desperately tried to turn it into a rant about King's Quest 8, but you've delved back into
Quest for Glory 5. I don't care about King's Quest 8, and I don't think we should rant about
it. I know, that's why I brought it up.
I don't think we should rant about it until you've at least played it, so... But anyway, yeah, that's my point. Quest for Glory 5 is a good game, it's a good ending to the series, and anyone who thinks otherwise can just eat an avocado sandwich for all I care.
I like avocado.
Good. Then you should play Quest for Glory 4, because there's a lot of avocado jokes in that game.
I see. Anyway, back to the topic at hand.
What was the topic at hand? I thought we were going to talk about, like, skills, and all we're doing is talking about...
Well, I think this is the thing. I think being able to recognize when you need motivating is a skill. I think being able to...
Sure.
to recognize where your limitations are a skill. They're not skills in the sense that you can go and get a certificate in drawing or, you know, or do a writing course, but I think they're still skills and they're important to identify as such.
All this talk about skills makes me think of Liam Neeson's speech from the movie Taken where he's like, I have a very particular set of skills and I will come for you and I will find you or whatever he says.
This is usually it's me that delays that waylays the podcast, but it's you today. This is a nice change.
I'm sleepy and I want to.
This is what happens when Francisco goes out drinking.
This is what happens.
He turns into me.
Turn into Ben Chandler.
That's why I never need alcohol. My natural state is Francisco Gonzalez, but tipsy or hungover.
Good.
But yeah, so I think that's a thing.
Yes. Yes, it is.
And yeah, like...
Sorry.
And yeah, like I said before, like, it's kind of hard to remember how some of that stuff works. The very act of picking AGS as an engine is an act of identifying the fact that you don't have the skills necessary to produce an engine yourself. That's a step. That's an important step. An important act, you know?
There is that. There's other adventure game engines, too.
Yeah, but that's what I mean. It's like... hard to think of that as an important step, but it really is.
Our friend Dane Krams uses Visionaire.
Yeah, and also Jacob Janerka.
Yes, that's
correct. Who you don't know, but I do. And
I just added him on Skype, and he accepted my friend request, so perhaps I will know him.
There you go. But yeah, so it's weird how little stuff like identifying where your problems are, identifying the reasons why your game's not getting done. Because it used to always sort of frustrate me when you talk to a lot of AGS people and you say to them, how's your game going? You know, I'm excited, I want to play it. And they're like, oh, nobody finishes their game here. And I always used to think, well, why? What's holding you up? What's stopping you? Identify that and finish the game that you like doing. You know what somebody once said to me here, and I don't want to name names, but this was a really weird thing that someone said to me. Said, I have trouble coming up with ideas. Like, of to make a game about. I'm like, well, really?
I mean, that's not such a strange thing, you know.
Isn't it?
Well,
I think
feasible ideas that actually would work and make a good adventure game, it's easy. Well, did they say that they couldn't come up with ideas in general, or that they couldn't come up with any good ideas for what would make a good game? There's a very big difference between the two.
This is something that I think should be addressed, because I know the project we're currently on, the form that you first envisioned the project in was fairly, you know, immature and didn't really have much to it.
Well, that's because I am myself am immature and there's not much to me, so...
I know. But for me, there's no such thing as a good idea or a bad idea. I think there's well-developed ideas and there's underdeveloped ideas. Mm-hmm. And an undeveloped idea feels like a bad idea, but really it's just a concept which is lacking something which makes it stick, you know, for me. So for me, instead of dismissing an idea and going, oh, that doesn't work, it's about stop looking at all the no's and start looking at the yes. Don't think in problems, think in solutions. Why isn't it working? What can we change to make that work? You know, there's an old saying which says you can't polish a turd.
Yes.
Which is kind of like, you know, but that doesn't always apply to ideas, I don't think. I think most ideas came to people because there's something in them that made them say, that's an idea to think about. Mm-hmm. There's something in them that interested them, you know. Mm. And I think most ideas, even if they're not salvageable in their pure form, there's something you can take away from them and apply to either something else or, you know, or re-envision in a more usable format. So that was really weird for me to hear someone say that. Like, I can't come up with any ideas to make a game about. Because I think, you know, I'm sure you can come up with ideas, but you're not developing them to a point where they're usable yet.
Yeah, sure.
I think that's the difference. You know, it's like people say, I can't draw anything. What a load of bullshit. It's easy to get a pencil, pick it up, put it down on a piece of paper. You've drawn something.
Yeah.
The point is you have to stick at it until it looks good, you know. It's the same with, like, oh, people saying, oh, I can't write anything. Yes, you can.
It just takes a lot of patience.
It takes patience, it takes skill, and it takes, perseverance.
Yeah, because it's easy to get frustrated by
sure, but stuff. But this is, it's important to remember that people don't just sit down and make a game and go, oh, blah, 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 there's a game, it's done.
Of course, yeah.
It takes a lot, like, it's the whole 99% perspiration, 1% inspiration rule absolutely applies.
Uh-huh.
Anybody, it used to really upset me, not upset me, but it really used to sort of...
It makes me so mad.
Why I oughta...
You know what I hate, Cletus?
Tell me, Bubba.
I got nothing. Go ahead.
I had a friend who I actually... We've lost touch and we don't talk anymore. And, you know, our lives went separate ways.
You're out of touch?
I'm out of time. He would say to me, he said, oh, I've got lots of ideas for games. How about this? I'll come up with the ideas and you make them.
No.
And I'm like, dude, you honestly have no idea how this works.
That's people who show up on the AGS forums and put in the recruitment thread, oh, I have great ideas, but I need a writer and a designer and an artist and a coder and a musician and everything. And it's like, what are you going to do? You're just going to sit there and say, hey, let's do this. No.
Had the idea, yeah. That's anybody can have an idea, you know?
Yeah, no. It's, you need a lot more than just an idea to make a game.
Yeah, that's like, people get excited and they announce their projects very early. One thing that I used to always, people like, why do you never do a games in production thread, Ben?
Well, yeah.
And I'm like, because I don't like to get overexcited and announce stuff early, you know?
Yeah.
On the same hand, I think early feedback's very helpful, you know? Yeah. And comprehensive feedback.
Early feedback's been really good for our current project, but yeah, I'm guilty of starting games in production threads kind of early myself, actually. I started the games in production thread for Golden Wake in February of 2013, and it's now being released in October of 2014, so there you go.
Yeah, but I saw somebody that they give a piece of advice, which was like, you know, announce your project early, start talking about it early, get people excited about it. But I'm like, it always worries me when I see Kickstarter is a really big place where you see this. You see some projects being announced, and you look at what they've actually got to show, and there's nothing there. There's two pieces of concept art, and there's an idea.
Yeah, sure.
They haven't developed a workable prototype, so they don't know if their idea is any fun.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, that's sin number one. Make sure a thing's going to work before you start working on it properly. That's why we have the prototyping phase. You know? So that always worries me when I see that. And then you see other stuff like Paradigm, which is, you know, Jacob's game, which we were recently looked at. And you can see this guy's put tons. He showed me a photo of his bedroom way before he even did his Kickstarter or everything like that. And his walls are covered in notes. There's just like notes everywhere. He's like, I'm just this possessed man. I'm like, dude, that's cool because you've clearly thought about your project. You clearly put the work into it, you know?
Sure.
You're not coming and asking for funding for like, hey guys, I woke up this morning and I had this cool idea. Let's make it a game. Oh, by the way, I need $120,000.
Yeah.
You know, which a lot of Kickstarter projects do that. And when they do that, it always feels very naive to me.
Yeah.
You know, oh, we've got this great idea, we're excited, and we want to make it into a game. Well, okay, I've got great ideas too. I've got fantastic ideas. You know, I've thought of some amazing first-person shooter games. You could give me $70,000 and don't think that I'd come out the other end with a great first-person shooter game. I promise you it would suck because I don't have the experience, you know?
If somebody gave you $70,000, you would just spend it all on pizza and Nesquik and stuff which you would use to fuel your first-person shooter play sessions of all weekend.
Are you kidding me? I'd spend on, like, I'd get every box DOS game there was. I'd get every box PC game ever. Spend on food. I don't want to eat. I want games. But you know, that's what I mean. Like, I mean, you tell me right now, I'm sure you could come up with an idea for a game like that's not in a genre that you're used to working in, and you think it's a great idea and go, yeah, there's really something to that. I'm sure anybody can do that. I used to design action games in my head when I was walking to the school bus stop. That's what I did. I would design the games in my head, and I thought they were great. And I look back at them now, and I go, that's not a design. There's no game there. That's you going, oh, wouldn't it be cool if I had an action game?
Naughty Ben. Naughty young Ben. Go back in time and kick yourself in the butt.
Yeah. That's the thing, you know. I thought they were ideas. They weren't ideas.
No.
They were just little... They were concepts which didn't form a complete sort of design or a complete piece of inspiration. They were just like, oh, wouldn't it be cool if there was a bit with snow and the, you know,
that was
all it was to it.
If there was a bit of snow and you were a lady and you could pee on the snow and write your name on the snow, that would be amazing.
Well, I fully developed that concept.
I know.
Ben's 304's snow riding simulator 2011 was gold. That was a gold wake, that one.
That was a golden shower is what it was.
But my point here is that just because you have an idea, you know, that doesn't mean you're ready to start working on a game. It's about knowing what it takes to go from that concept phase to an actual finished quality game that makes it, you know. And I think if you're not making a quality game and you know that, you'll stop working on it.
Oh yeah, sure.
You know, nobody likes working on shovelware. No. It always worries me, like, you see a lot of, especially now that the iPhone market's so open and that anyone can make an app and release it, and I read some stupid stat the other day that there's more games released on the iPhone every day or every week or something like that than the entire NES catalog.
Ugh.
Which seems feasible, you know, because you got 40,000... You know, Angry Birds clones and 40,000 Flappy Bird clones, you know, that get lost in like this sea of who cares apps.
I actually heard two different things from two different speakers about mobile apps. One which made me sad and the other one which just made me sadder. The one that made me sad was Adam Saltzman saying that 99% of all free-to-play apps are downloaded, played and deleted off of phones in like a span of like 2 minutes.
Well, look at them.
And well, yeah.
The and other not to be arrogant and saying, "Oh, their games suck," but you know,
a lot of them are very copycats and just trying to cash in on things. And yes, there's not a lot of effort put into them. But the other thing that made me sadder was at the demo night, there was a guy who was developing an arcade basketball thing, and he talked about how the new thing is now this apparent playing games for cash and like actually betting, and how it's legal in 37 states, and like, yeah, it's like the next, and if that's the case, that's really sad.
They tried that with a multiplayer shooter, one that was developed in Australia, actually, where there was actually, like, you had to buy bullets and stuff like that. This was in, like, the peak of, like, Quake 3, Counter-Strike,
This is different. Thing. This isn't so much about buying as it is about making money. It's like you play multiplayer sports matches, for example, and you bet.
This was to make money as well.
Oh, okay.
And you can guess how well that succeeded. Have you ever heard of the game? I don't even remember what it's called. That's how well it succeeded.
Well, there you go.
So, you know, I don't want to sound like dubious, but I'll be surprised if that turns into a long run thing.
Yeah. Actually, speaking of money, I got a very nice donation from someone this morning on PayPal for Ben Jordan. Do you know how much they donated?
No, I don't know how much I donated, and I don't feel like guessing, so please tell everybody.
It was $13.37.
How elite.
I know.
It was me mentioning Counter-Strike what brought that up.
Yeah, and money.
Yeah. But, yeah, so I'd be surprised, but a thing that gets me, like, if you're making a clone game, mm-hmm. you know, if you're making Pac-Man 2 or whatever...
They already made Pac-Man 2.
I mean, if you're making Packy, there we go. Sure, and I didn't mean that as the.
Oh, don't even go there! Don't even go there.
Yeah, that's actually a Pac-Man clone for PlayStation 2. Okay. But if you're making that, maybe that's going to be satisfying when you don't have the skill set to make a game and you're still learning. But once you've got the skills to make a game, don't think that's going to stay rewarding. Don't think that's going to turn into a fulfilling career.
Well, it's like making fan games. That's essentially what it is. Mm. People who make like Monkey Island fan games where they just rip the sprites from the old games, and plenty of people did that back in the day. And
Plenty of people did.
Yeah. You know, I'm guilty of it too. You know, you rip sprites from other games, you put them in yours, and you think, oh, look, I'm making this awesome game and it's going to be the next great game. And then, but all it is basically just the copy paste job of, you know, it's a dilution of the original stuff. It's
slightly different making a fan game because you can put, like, you know, you can write in stuff that makes it interesting. But there's a lot of direct clones of, like, Flappy Bird and stuff like that.
Yeah.
That. It's just shovelware, and I don't think that's going to really get you inspired for a long-term sort of enjoyment of making games. You're not setting yourself up with the sort of abilities that are going to get you somewhere.
Yeah, exactly.
And I don't mean get you somewhere in terms of monetary success. I mean in believing that the work you're doing is fun and rewarding and creative.
Yeah. I mean, that's not to say that, you know, because, I mean, plenty of people have made fan games that are inspired by other games that are fine. I'm talking about, like, just, like, cloning, ripping, and, like, what I did. Don't do what I did, kids, because it's not going to get you anywhere.
Learn from my mistakes. But, yeah, but I think it's important to recognize that we're all creative people. We've all got our own unique voice, and instead of just going, I like...
Big butts, and I cannot lie.
I like Monkey Island, so I'm going to make Monkey Island.
Yes, there you go.
It's important to go, I'm going to make Monkey Island, so I'm going to take the things about Monkey Island that I like, you know, whether it's the sort of meta humor or the, you know, the diversity in puzzles.
Yes.
And I'm going to turn that into something that's my own.
But please, please, for the love of God, don't make a game. Don't be like, oh, I really like Monkey Island. I'm going to do my own and make it about a pirate named, like, Grub Plank Nosefoot, who needs to solve a treasure hunt or
that
something.
That feels like a really obvious piece of advice. I don't think anyone's that. Well, I mean...
I've seen pretty much that exact game several times in my life, so...
But these were all surely from younger developers.
It was a while ago, so yeah, it seems like not many people are doing it anymore nowadays, which is, I guess, a good thing. But yeah, please don't make a game about like a king named King, you know, Shortbread, and who has to collect magical treasures 3 or anything like that.
Hey, you like Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows, and that's basically collecting magic treasures 3.
No, it's collecting magic treasures 7 and destroying them.
Yeah, well, they had to get the medallion at first, then they had to get the sword, then that's 2. Then they had to get the...
No, the sword wasn't a horcrux. The sword was a...
But it's still a magical thing they had to get.
Yeah, but it was a magical item that they needed to use, the weapon to... Why are we talking about Harry Potter?
Because it was a sad motivation for a film.
What?
It was basically chasing MacGuffins the entire film.
Well, you can't go into the last movie and having not experienced the rest and be like, oh, this is... Yes, it is chasing MacGuffins, but there's a reason for it.
Well, there's always a reason for chasing MacGuffins.
If it had just been like straight up.
I'm not saying it's a bad film. I told you I enjoyed it.
I know, but just the story is
reliant on MacGuffins.
I know, but it's because there's, you know, 6 books/movies worth of backstory that's led up to this point. That's all.
Okay.
That's all I'm saying. If you are going to make a story and you're gonna start off your story and your story is gonna be based on chasing MacGuffins, that's shit, because there's no rhyme or reason for it. But if you've established some sort of lore or something, oh boy, lore, and then you have MacGuffins, then it's slightly less inexcusable. That's all I'm saying, okay? Leave me alone.
What a fanboy.
You hush, or I'll cast the Avada Kedavra curse
on
you.
I'm sorry for casting criticism of your all-time favorite IP, clearly.
Oh, give me a break. It's not my all-time favorite IP. I just My favorite all-time IP is when I pee in the toilet because it's delicious.
Oh, dear. Dad jokes.
Oh. Oh, no.
Anyway, yes. Anyway, let's move on from me making fun of you for liking things.
Do we have to? Can we wrap things up? I'm tired of talking.
Oh, sure. Yeah, we can wrap up. I think we've covered some points.
Yes,
we've done more than me scorning your favorite things. And
hush,
then pretending that King's Quest VIII is important.
Listen, don't you start, because I will say some naughty things about Doom so fast.
You're welcome to try.
Oh, I'm welcome to try, am I?
Yeah.
Well, I'm not going to, because I don't want to hurt your feelings.
I'll just mock you. I'll just laugh at you.
Don't fart at me.
I just did.
Well, good.
Honestly, Francisco, in your current state, it's best that we wrap up this podcast.
You are absolutely right. I need a nap.
You so do. Thank you for listening, everybody. I am at Ben_304 on Twitter, if you'd like to follow me.
And if you'd like to follow me, I promise I'll say much more coherent things on Twitter, at Grundislav Games. And
I will say this.
Yes?
That we require further proof of. That's to be seen.
I always tweet coherent things. Don't start with me.
Well, okay, I'm going to say this. I do not, so don't plan on anything amazing if you follow me.
Well, fair enough.
And together we are, by our powers combined, we are...
BCT _ podcast, and you can, yes, be updated on our antics.
You can, yes.
Owner of a lonely heart. Goodbye.